Well, it's good to be with you this morning. I've given three main lectures or talks so far. At chapel, I spoke on the theological significance of intelligent design. Then at a luncheon seminar yesterday, or luncheon talk, I spoke about the history of the design movement, some of the key texts, some of the ideas, what was happening there. And then in the evening lecture yesterday, I spoke about the scientific content of intelligent design, showed what was really going on, what were the problems facing evolutionary biology, and how intelligent design, at least I sketched out, how intelligent design was promising to handle them. I've titled this talk rather, I guess, pretentiously, The Design Revolution. I've been in the sciences now for about 15, 20 years, and scientific revolutions are, in some cases, really quite overblown. I was involved in one of those in the late 80s. You may remember chaos and nonlinear dynamics, and chaos is still mentioned quite a bit, but at the time, this was going to revolutionize science. The idea was that you have these chaotic systems that are very sensitive to slight changes, perturbations, and then they can have extremely different behaviors just with, even though they're following the same dynamics, if you trace them out over time. So one of the things that's was pointed to is the butterfly effect. If you had a butterfly flap its wings, let's say in Brazil, it could change weather patterns in the United States 3 weeks down the line. And the thing is, I mean, there's an insight there which was important, but I would say it really didn't revolutionize science. It was, you know, it's a useful insight that we've taken with us. So when I talk about intelligent design as a revolution, and I'm conscious that revolutions have been overblown. So what I want to do in this talk is first sketch out the historical history of science landscape, what has happened historically with some of the main revolutions, and how does intelligent design fit in? Why should we think that there really is something revolutionary afoot and not just the latest flash in the pan, as it were? And after I do that, I want to make it more practical, just say, well, what's really going on culturally, scientifically? How is this going to play out in coming years? So it'll be there'll be a sharp shift from a historical study, historical philosophical study, to sort of a more cultural, pragmatic look at it. So let's back up just a little bit, because I want to sketch out the picture of the world that modern science has given us, because that's really what intelligent design is challenging. But to do that, I want to back up a little further. What was the picture of the world that modern science challenged? And that picture was really an Aristotelian worldview. Aristotle in the Middle Ages was the philosopher. When you talked about the philosopher, it was just Aristotle. Nowadays, we don't think of just the philosopher. There are many philosophers that we think of in many philosophies. But Aristotle was the philosopher. And C.S. Lewis wrote a book, The Discarded Image, which described this medieval worldview, this worldview in which Aristotle played such an important role. That image, as the title of C.S. Lewis's book suggests, was discarded. And so what happened there? Why was it discarded? Well, what was that image? I think it was a rich image, but let me just, for the sake of, you know, what modern science was responding to, let me give you a thumbnail sketch. And this is not, I'm not doing justice to the Aristotelian worldview, but I think what was key and what the formulators of modern science were keying off of was Aristotle's distinction of four causes. And for Aristotle, to understand a phenomenon, you have to understand four aspects of it. And it's usually, it'll be called the efficient, material, formal, and final cause. Now, think of it this way. I mean, this is often how you introduce it in philosophy courses, and you've probably heard it. But, you know, you think of a statue. What's its material? What's it made out of? Well, it's made out of marble, let's say. Think of Michelangelo's David. Then there's an efficient cause. There's the chipping away, the actual chipping away, which leads to the statute. Then there's, so that's the efficient cause that brings it about. But then there's also the formal cause. And the form is not just the shape. I mean, it's its essence. What is that statue? That's a statue of David. There's a figure there. There's a meaning, an essence that belongs to it. And what is the final cause? Well, what were the purposes that led to that statue being built, being constructed? Maybe it was to beautify some Florentine palace. Those were the purposes that were moving it. Now, Francis Bacon was one of the key people in the formulation of modern science. He made a sharp distinction. He was not a scientist himself, but he was a great proponent of what science should be like, and he was a great opponent of Aristotle. And for Bacon, formal and final causes were not properly part of science. What science should focus on were efficient and material causes. Formal and final causes were moved into metaphysics. And you see that distinction even to this day among, there are Aristotelians who still work. I think of somebody like Stanley Yockey. There's a fellow named Rick Machuga who has now written recently a book for Brazos Press, where you basically split those off. Science deals with efficient and material causes, formal and final causes. Now, formal and final causes, that's the realm of agency, design, mind, purposes. All of that is just shunted aside into metaphysics. And so science will now focus on just efficient and material causes. Now, when you have that bifurcation, what comes in is a mechanistic worldview. And it's a worldview in which what science can deal with, what are the ultimate constituents? Well, they're particles, matter in motion. So you try to understand the dynamics of that matter in motion. But there's no purposiveness then that goes along that you can understand scientifically. Robert Boyle, who was one of the great purveyors of this view, he was a Christian, thoroughly Christian in his view. He was fully behind this bifurcation of material and efficient causes to the one side, formal and final causes to the other, and he gave actually a theological justification for it. For him, if you had formal or final causes in nature, and they were operating in nature for Aristotle, that would detract from the glory of God, because he wanted God to get all the glory for any sort of for the miracles, for the organization of creation. All of this would be attributed to God. So what you had was really an inert nature, a nature just run by efficient and material causes, which then God would form in certain ways, maybe set up the initial conditions or act miraculously in it. So, because Bacon was an Orthodox Christian, he believed that God could act miraculously. But what you had then was a nature that was no longer where your scientific study of nature, any sort of design or purposiveness was something that God put there. And once, and so when you study the material by itself, there's no evidence of God's action. Let me try to make this a little clearer. The material view, the mechanistic view that emerges is one of matter in motion ruled by unbroken natural laws. What you get is really what you could call a causal closure thesis. It's that unless God is acting in the world, the world becomes this autonomous system of matter in motion ruled by natural laws. That's the picture that emerges. Now, natural laws in that picture, you should think of natural laws in terms of a conditional, if-then. If certain antecedent conditions are fulfilled, then certain consequences will happen. And this can happen both deterministically and non-deterministically. Deterministically, it's if A happens, then B must happen. non-deterministically, if A happens, then B can happen with a certain probability. That's really the only difference between what happens in the classical view of science, where everything is deterministic. This is with Newton and Laplace, and then with the quantum view, where you have still natural laws, but they become probabilistic laws. And so you have this view where everything is ruled by natural laws, unless God sticks his finger into the system of the world. Okay. Now, that view, I mean, you can think of it as a billiard ball view of the world. You have billiard balls on a pool table, they're moving around, they have their own inherent motion, and then for God to act in the world, God has to either move a billiard ball, divert a billiard ball, do something to the motion. God has to get in there and move the particles. Now, for a scientist who's trying to understand how particles are moving and what are the laws for the billiard balls to move, if that's the picture of divine action, then for God to get into the system and poke the finger in, and you actually see this sort of language with contemporary theologians and people who deal with science and theology, it becomes a very unpleasing picture of the world. I mean, here you are a scientist, you're trying to understand how billiard balls work, and now you say, well, and then there's God who can come in and upset the whole thing. You know? Well, in that case, God's action undermines your scientific study of the world, right? Because, I mean, God is sticking the finger into this billiard ball system, this mechanistic system, and you're no longer really understanding it when God acts. And so divine action, any sort of role of purposiveness or design, actually becomes incoherent within a mechanistic worldview. And you see this today very much so in the science theology, a lot of the science theology discourse. So that's the picture that we get from the scientific, really the emergence of modern science. It's a mechanistic worldview. It's interesting that people like Newton and Boyle still held on to divine action, God's purposiveness. God would, for Newton, may have set up some initial conditions and then lets the system run and then periodically intervenes to stabilize the solar system. But then Laplace comes along with his celestial dynamics and shows that, hey, the solar system is stable. God doesn't need to come in and stabilize things, move the planets a little bit. And then suddenly, bit by bit, God's role in the world seems to be less and less called for. What's more, I mean, within this mechanistic picture, a more competent creator is one who builds a world in which he never has to intervene at all, right? I mean, you think of, I mean, the metaphor of this time was the clockwork, the mechanism. And, you know, what is the best clock you could build? Is it one that you constantly have to wind, that you constantly have to adjust and set the time? A better mechanism is one which is self-winding, self-perpetuating, doesn't need any intervention. In fact, an even better watch would be one that can just build itself, that doesn't need a watchmaker at all. And I think you see in the logic, there's a logic which goes, which just drives you with this modern mechanistic causal closure worldview, where you start, I mean, the thing is, these are Christians who are giving us this worldview. They're saying, you know, we've got this, you know, we're going to get, put formal and final causes to the side. We're just going to focus on efficient and material causes. But then they construe that in a mechanistic way. Efficient causes operate mechanistically. The world is particles in motion, pushing, pulling, operating by purely mechanistic forces. God sets that all up. God needs to set up initial conditions. God needs to intervene, poke his fingers into things for a while, but that doesn't really help the scientist understand what the inherent laws are of the billiard balls, as it were. Bit by bit, God gets moved out. You know, you study how the billiard balls move, you find that there's less and less need to invoke God. The system seems to work just fine. And then finally, the system just creates itself. And I think you can see Darwinism as just an extension of that, because here we're talking really about physics and chemistry. You can see that as an extension of it to biology, where For Darwin, you just have biological organisms build themselves. You know, it's the mechanistic process, and for him, the mechanism was natural selection and random variation. Again, the divine finger is not needed. Okay, so that's the conception of the world which we get from modern science, and it's one in which, you know, God is not welcome. A designer is not welcome because it upsets our view of the world. Richard Lewontin, Harvard geneticist, very well known and also with access, high-profile public intellectual who's got access to all the high-profile publications, wrote in the New York Review of Books. He was reviewing Carl Sagan's last book right after Carl Sagan had died. And he was saying that we can't allow the divine foot in the door. Our materialism must be absolute, because if we do allow the divine foot, our science will just go bust, because anything could happen. God can be capricious. You know, any sort of designer can do stuff which our science will not be able to handle it. There's no way for science to track a capricious deity. Now, why should any sort of designer or deity that interacts with the world be capricious? You think about that. Why is that? Why can't a designer act rationally? I flew on a plane here. The pilot was an intelligent agent guiding the plane. It was not a mechanistic material process that led me here. I wasn't worried about on the plane whether the pilot would crash the plane into the ground, even though the pilot could do that capriciously. In fact, I'm much more worried about natural forces, material mechanisms, weather and things like that, than about the intelligence of the pilot. And you think about it also, there's a real tension here because, it is our intelligence that allows us to do science. It is in virtue of our intelligence, which can be capricious, that we can do science. And yet, we are told by the scientists that for science to be rational, the world at a fundamental level must be unintelligent. So that means that our intelligence, arises from an unintelligent process, by a process of evolution, presumably, which then allows us to understand that. But it must be unintelligent to start, otherwise the world becomes irrational. It's just a weird sort of logic, but I think it flows very directly out of this materialist conception of the world, which we get then from modern science, even though the purveyors, the architects of it, were not themselves materialists. And I think that's one of the great ironies. Well, what does intelligent design bring to the show, bring to the party in all of this? And I think to try to clarify how intelligent design promises to overturn this picture of the world, C.S. Lewis talked about the discarded image of the Aristotelian medieval worldview. What is it going to take for this worldview given to us by modern science to become a discarded image? And it is an image. There's a clockwork image to it. There's a sense of, we've got this enclosed system that operates by natural laws. What are these natural laws? What sort of status do they have? Are they inviolable? As Christian theists, is it a fact that God has created these laws? Or are these regularities? Are these sort of, could these more be conceived of, when the sun rises in the morning and sets, should this be seen more as a policy statement by our God? This is what I'd like to see happen, but it's not that there's any sort of inherent necessity. I'm just playing with you here for a moment, but there's an image here. There are metaphors which are being worked and which we're asked to buy into by the modern scientific worldview, and they can be questioned. That's really what I'm trying to get at here. So, how should we think of intelligent design then in relation to this modern scientific conception? I think a helpful way to think about it is really, a way that Aristotle would have found congenial, although it takes a few liberties with Aristotle. But think of it this way. you've got a, think of the following distinction. We've got material world, there's matter. It's out there. It can be structured in various ways. Now this structuring, the way it can be structured, think of that as information. So you've got matter, can take a lot of different forms, and whatever form it takes is information. So think of if I had a blackboard here, I'd put a vertical line, I'd have information at the top and matter at the bottom. So you can think of matter as this, where does the word matter come from? It's from materia, it refers to really wood that was meant to be formed. So it's this passive, inert stuff. And then there's information, which will shape it in various ways. Okay, now draw a horizontal line rather, and put nature on one side, design on the other. How does matter get informed? How does matter get shaped? Well, one possible way it happens is that natural forces operate. Another way it happens is that a designer acts on the matter and thereby informs it, gives shape to it. Now, Aristotle knew of this distinction, and he actually illustrated it quite nicely. In terms of nature informing things, bringing shape to things, he gave the example of an acorn. An acorn, turns into an oak tree. Okay, and as it turns into an oak tree, the oak gets formed, the information gets applied to the matter. And that happens by an internal process. It's not that anything is shaping the matter from outside. It is within the oak, the acorn, to form into an oak tree. Now, on the other hand, if you just take raw pieces of wood, there's no internal power for those raw pieces of wood to form themselves into a ship. And so Aristotle will write, the art of shipbuilding is not in the wood. The art of oak tree building is in the acorn. But the art of shipbuilding is not in the wood. If you're going to get a ship out of raw pieces of wood, there's going to have to be design imposed on it. And so the distinction is between information that arises internally through natural forces and information that arises externally through design or intelligence being imposed. So that's a picture. And which we actually get from Aristotle. And what intelligent design then is saying is that there's certain types of information structures, and I'm just repeating myself really from previous lectures, but I'm putting it in a slightly different idiom. There are structures, informational structures that we see in the world, instantiated in material objects, which require intelligence, which you cannot get by purely natural forces. And so structures like that would be Michael Behe's irreducibly complex biochemical systems, or more generally what I call specified complexity, these high probability, independently patterned or objectively patterned events. Those sorts of events or objects that are the result of such events, those will be beyond the capacity of natural forces to bring them about. And so what intelligent design is then saying is that there is an incompleteness to the natural forces that one needs, that if we try to understand the forces of by which matter operates, there's no inherent self-organizational or creative power in the matter to bring about the structures that we see in biology and also in some cases in cosmology. You can think of it this way. Karl Marx used to boast that he had 26 soldiers, and with those he would conquer the world. Okay, what were those soldiers? Those were the 26 letters of the alphabet. Okay, and he actually did pretty well for a time. I mean, about 1.6 billion people, I think at its height, were under some sort of Marxist-Leninist or Marxist regime. So now those letters, those 26 soldiers, needed to be arranged. But there's no inherent power of those 26 letters. If you just have Scrabble pieces, letters of the alphabet. There's no inherent power in those Scrabble pieces to arrange themselves into meaningful texts, which then can convey ideas, influence people, capture their imagination, cause people to be dominated by an ideology. So it has to come from an intelligence imposing order on those letters. And so similarly, what we would want to suggest and really argue in intelligent design is that we can show that the properties of the material world, the natural forces that operate, are like those Scrabble pieces. They don't have the inherent capacity to bring about the sorts of structures that we see in biology. Now that's really, I would put it to you, is revolutionary stuff, because it's saying that nature is fundamentally incomplete, that it does require an intelligence to operate in and through nature to bring about the structures that we see. And I think this is very consistent with certainly a Christian worldview, but it's totally at odds with the conception of science. When I talk about modern science, I'm thinking 16th, 17th century, what was given to us by Galileo, Newton, Copernicus. That's what we call modern science, and that the view that we get from modern science is one in which nature is closed. It's a closed system. It's not open to novel information. So it's and it's not saying that you can still study the processes, the regularities in nature. Gravitation, the various laws of nature that we understand. Nothing goes by the board. All of the results of modern science, the valid results, stay, but they don't acquire, they don't have that status as inviolable truths or things that cannot be suspended or overruled as a result of intelligence's acting. And intelligence, when I say overruled, it's not that when intelligence is act, that they violate any sort of principles or natural laws that are operating. It's what really intelligent design is saying is that these laws are incomplete, that intelligence can act in ways where laws are not violated, and yet the intelligence still becomes evident. Think of it this way. Let's say I throw down a bunch of Scrabble pieces, and they end up spelling, Hamlet's soliloquy. Now, if you track every single Scrabble piece, okay, you have the video camera on it, you say, gee, there's nothing miraculous that was happening. The laws of physics were being obeyed as best we can tell, no violation of the dynamics. It's not that, the Scrabble piece would have landed there, but then for some inexplicable reason, it landed here. Locally, if you look at any single piece, everything seems to be following perfectly fine physical trajectories. And yet, in the coordination of those pieces to form a meaningful text, you'd have to say, but there was design operating. Even though I can't see at the micro level or at the individual level any divine or intelligent interaction, and yet, in the global behavior of it, I know there is an intelligence involved there. And that's really what we're saying with intelligent design, that we can see patterns that don't violate natural laws, but which natural laws can't account for either, and for which we need intelligence. So I think that is huge. And the thing is, we can do science with that, because we know what the limitations are on natural laws. What are the probabilities that natural laws would dictate? And then we can say, okay, now, the patterns that emerge here are the result of an intelligence. So it's, I think, it challenges fundamentally the scientific picture. Scientific picture, as it's been given to us, is a closed picture. And it's interesting, theologically, this was very much taken up by liberal theology. Friedrich Schleiermacher, in his, notice a few faces just went up. It's like good to be in a theological setting here. But Schleiermacher, the father of modern liberal theology, he was trying to understand Christian theology within a naturalized setting in which nature was conceived as a closed causal nexus. It calls it the system of nature. This is in his Christian faith. That's how he understands it. Nature is this closed causal nexus. And within that closed causal nexus, he then has to try to reinterpret, if that's what the world is, this closed causal nexus, how do you make sense out of Christianity? And it ends up being all, everything that ends up becoming experientially based, this feeling of dependence on God, and, miracles, any sort of coherent divine action ends up disappearing. So I think this picture, scientific pictures, has had huge implications for theology. But if intelligent design is right, if the world is fundamentally an open system in which it's open to true novelties, novelties by an intelligence, then I think a lot of the things that are important to us as Orthodox Christian, traditional views of miracles, divine action, God's providential care and guidance in history, become much more intelligible, than they would within a scientistic worldview. So I do think there's a revolution afoot. I think this promises to change our picture of the world in a fundamental way. Let me also, just to say a little bit more about what will change. Maybe get a little bit more specific with the science. It's interesting when you look at the history of modern science. You have Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, and the picture that emerges from their work is the science. It becomes a very deterministic picture. The laws that govern things are deterministic. So if you know the dynamics and position of certain particles at one point, you can with complete accuracy predict what's going to happen in the future. That changes with quantum mechanics in that now the laws become probabilistic. So instead of knowing with exact certainty where something is going to be, if you know with perfect precision where things were in the past, now you've got some probability distributions that you have to work with. But it's still the conception there is still one of laws governing things. Now, one of the problems also with this picture is trying to fit human agency into all of this, because if we're just embodied physical beings and we are everything that we do, human action is governed by these laws, then human agency, it would seem, just dissolves. If everything is entirely determined by physics, if it's a deterministic picture, then there's no freedom even possible that we can talk of. But if it's an indeterministic picture that if the laws are non-deterministic, but still where it's where there are laws with probabilities of things happening given certain antecedent circumstances, that still doesn't really open up a possibility of real human freedom, because what we've got then is you can think of it, there's just you're about to do an action and there's a little coin that gets flipped in your brain, and if it lands a certain way then you do this, if it lands another way you do that. There's no if that's what's happening, it's just an algorithm with access, deterministic algorithm, but then with access to certain random coin flippings at times, that doesn't really open up the possibility of much robust view of human freedom, And I think one of the things that comes out of intelligent design, this is a view, an idea that I've been exploring, I mentioned it a little bit in my most recent book, is that it promises to turn the whole conception of chance really on its head, where chance is not seen as something fundamental or intrinsic, but as something that derives from really an underlying design. And let me just say a little bit about this. I want to develop this at much greater length in a book at some point. But think of You know, if you're writing at a computer, you're writing English text, there'll be certain probability distributions that will be associated with the letters that come out. You know, the letter E will come out with approximately 12 to 13% likelihood. Letter S will be pretty high. The letter Q would be pretty low, you know, less than 1%. U will follow Q with probability 1. So there'll be various probabilities associated with your intelligent action. Okay, and those probabilities will be very reliable. In fact, if the probabilities are violated, there'll be reason to think that there was design for their violation. There was a novel, for instance, written in 1939 by somebody named Ernest Vincent Wright. It was titled Gadsby, and it was a novel of 50,000 words in which the letter E did not appear once. Now, think about that. The word the never appeared. You know, you're going to be quite limited in what you can write. Now, do you think that Ernest Vincent Wright woke up one day and said, you know, gee, I just wrote a 50,000 word novel and I never needed to use the letter E? What an amazing coincidence. You know? You know, I think the more reasonable inference is that, in fact, this was fully intended, and indeed it was intended. But my point is that agents do things that have well-defined probabilities that go with them. In fact, actuaries will do certain calculations where you're going to find that agents do things where they're well-defined probability distributions. And so the view which I want to develop within a design framework is that chance should be seen as an epiphenomenon, as a rider, or as a byproduct of design, where it's sort of like these probability distributions. If you're going to say something, if you're going to write something in English, there's certain conventions, you've got to spell the language in a certain way, you've got to do things, and those constraints that are also intelligently given, will lead to certain probabilities and certain apparent chance processes, even though underlying it is design. I mean, everything you write, unless you were totally spacing out, is fully intended. There's nothing chance about it if you're writing a meaningful communication. And yet, there are chance processes associated with it. So, on a design view, I think, it leads to some, I mean, I'm just trying to give you a sense that there's some interesting possibilities ahead. Because I think we think of, with modern science, it starts out where everything is necessity, deterministic natural law. Then quantum mechanics comes along, and then suddenly we've got law and chance, or necessity and chance. And now there's design, and that's adding, intelligent agency to the mix. But, chance has always been had kind of a funny status, because what is it? Is it just pure, uncaused, events just popping into existence for no reason at all? If there's some sort of fundamental design behind the world, is there a way to cash that out in a way that's more meaningful? This really brings me, I think this is probably a good transition point into the more popular implications of intelligent design, because I think at one level we're trying to, in the design movement, trying to bring about a revolution, do some new interesting science, trying to shake things up in the scientific establishment. But I think there's a broader concern, which is to hammer out a worldview that is going to capture people's imagination and really overcome this sort of suffocating materialist ideology that we get exposed to throughout the academy, from the media. And I think this, what I just sketched out for you, this possibility of reinterpreting chance as a byproduct of design, is one way of trying to make sense, make intelligible something within a design framework. And I think this is more of what we'll have to do. And I think theologically also we'll want to be doing this, making sense of intelligent design, putting it in a way where we've got a framework, a worldview that captures the imagination, that will bring people in because it is so attractive. And attractive in this case, not because it's seductive. I think this has been a feature of a lot of the materialism, that it's been seductive, but attractive because it is in fact also true. Pascal, I think it was in his Art of Persuasion, wrote that people almost invariably arrive at their beliefs not because of proof, but because of what they find attractive. And I think this is something we need to be sensitive to, at any rate, in the cultural engagement that I think is going to be coming up with intelligent design. So let me indicate a little bit, just what's happening with this cultural engagement. Where are we? We've got some bright people who are working in this area, some scientists who are now doing research, things which are in the pipeline. But where is this going, and what sort of resistance are we likely to face? I mentioned in one of my previous lectures that there are stages in which the reception of ideas go through. Arthur Schopenhauer was a three-stage taxonomy, where first it's ridiculed, an idea is ridiculed, then it's fiercely resisted, and then it's accepted as though it's always been true. There's a four-stage taxonomy, which evolutionist J.B.S. Haldane gave. I don't recall the quote, but I've summarized it with an alliteration, four P's. First, it's preposterous, then it's pernicious, then possible, and then plausible. Plausible, well, we always thought that way. It's just as natural as the air we breathe. And where are we now in this? And I think it depends, who you're talking to and the context within which you find yourself. The population at large seems very sympathetic to intelligent design. If you look at Gallup polls over the last 20 years, only about between 7% and 11% have consistently, are going with a strict materialist Darwinian line, the sort of picture, scientific picture that I sketched out of modern science. The rest hold to some form of purposive, divine, this God is somehow moving in the world. Almost half hold to a stricter sort of Genesis creation account. And about another 40% hold to some sort of God-guided evolution. That's been, a consistent pattern for 20 years, and Gallup polls have confirmed that. Okay. So that's when we're talking the population at large. But what happens when we move into the academy? What happens when we move into the creme de la creme, the highest echelons of the sciences? If you go to the National Academy of Sciences, this is the Mount Olympus of science here in the United States. You're going to have only about 7% that believe in a prayer-answering God. Any sort of faith there. So the numbers end up being totally reversed. And this has been my experience really in the secular academy as well, that the numbers are just totally reversed. I've been in several philosophy departments. I'm thinking in two of them, Northwestern and University of Illinois, was not aware of any Christian there in the department. These were, sizable philosophy departments. We're talking about 45 people total in these two departments. I think if any of you have been in the secular academy, I think this has probably been more or less your experience. Now, maybe I missed somebody, but there's no visible presence that I could see. And the sort of materialistic worldview that I've sketched out was just accepted right down the line. So where is this then going? I think we're going to find increasing strident resistance in the secular academy. I think that's going to happen for a while, because Darwinism and the materialism that supports it is a monopoly. There's a lot of money riding on it, a lot of prestige. People have built their careers on this. And to draw back, to even admit that what intelligent design is saying is a live possibility, do monopolists ever give up anything unless they're forced to? I mean, it doesn't happen. You're not going to give up that power. So I think there'll be resistance as long as it can be made. Now, how might that change, though? I think there's a younger generation that's coming up. I think they're going to be looking at these ideas. These ideas are now circulating on the internet. And in the age of the internet, there's much more information exchange. I have great confidence, actually, in a younger generation that's going to be challenging the establishment in this regard. It's interesting, actually, the media and what they've been doing with this, because even though I think a lot of the media, you know, they've been educated in the secular establishment, you know, I think they buy a lot of the presuppositions, and yet intelligent design, at least for now, is interesting news, because, you know, our arguments are good. Scientists on the other side, and the philosophers and the academicians, they are engaging us. The media is they're watching this, and they're saying, hey, there's something interesting, there's news here, there's something we can report. And I think that's all to the positive. You know, I think these ideas are going to be in the public consciousness, in the scientific consciousness, you know, and that's, I think, very helpful. I think one of the problems we face, though, realistically, with intelligent design is, the lack of resources to push this program forward. If you can compare, let's say, intelligent design with other scientific programs that have gotten going, let's say cognitive science in the last 20 to 30 years, if you were a young, up-and-coming scholar scientist and you wanted to work in cognitive science, it was an exciting field, there was money there, and there was a career waiting for you at the end of your course of study. You could be doing research, teaching at a good university. All of those were possibilities. If you want to do this in intelligent design, if you declare for intelligent design and you're, let's say in the field of biology in particular, you've pretty much ruined your chances of academic advancement and a career. So that's, I think, a real problem, and trying to do end runs around these hurdles is a problem. So, I've got colleagues who have to play it very close to the vest. I mentioned yesterday during the Q&A, one fellow I know who's extremely sharp, works in intelligent design, and is waiting to go public on this until he gets tenure. This is a pattern where a number of us have to play it close to the vest. In my case, my cards have been on the table. My career is ruined, so it's it doesn't matter at this point. But I just say what I want in this regard. But it's a real problem. So I trust a God who is able to do great things, and I often think of Gideon's band, where you just have a very small number of people who are still able to do amazing things just because, God empowers and gives us wisdom. And I think I see that happening as well. So there are positive signs, there's a lot of opposition, and I think just the opposition is itself confirmation that something important is going on. So I was thinking that we'd have a little time for Q&A, but I think we're probably right at the end there. So why don't I wrap it up? Thank you for your attention and patience, and I hope this was helpful.